Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. Wonderful place. Time flies when I'm here. So the title is Relativistic. Materials. For you it's an option, but for people watching online, I would say there is an excellent talk by Yongbak Kim on August the 3rd in the same program, who gave a fantastic Blackboard talk. And if you watch me first, watch him, I would say. But you're stuck with me. Okay. What I'll do, first, I'll tell you what relativistic materials are. I will show you where to find them and try to indicate why they are interesting. Then, in the second part, I will get somewhat more specialized and talk about the Kitaev model, especially the Kitaev model on a honeycomb lattice. Which is a model that's realized in certain relativistic materials. Say something about Majoranas and something about anions. Okay. So then let's start with what's a mod material. It's invented in Santa Barbara in 2007. Well, actually, the phrase was coined there. It's a mod material. And the mod material. And the concept of what a mod material is goes back to mod himself and Piles. 1937. And the easiest way to illustrate this concept is by looking, considering an array of hydrogen atoms. So if I have a hydrogen atom here, this is the nucleus, this is my electron circling around it, has a spin, and here's another one, and the spin is looking in a different direction, and here's another one. And I know that in this hydrogen atoms, I have a partially filled 1s orbital. I have a 1s1 configuration, if you want. These electrons, they are free to hop from one orbital, from one hydrogen to another. They can tunnel. So one process is you have two hydrogens. If this guy has spin up and the other guy has spin down, that this up spin can tunnel to the other hydrogen atom with a tunneling amplitude that I'll call T. You need to have different spins because of Pauli principle. If this guy tunnels, then it has to be, it cannot be the same spin, sitting in the same orbital at the same hydrogen. But that's an obvious process. What was pointed out later is the following, that if you have two electrons sitting here, this costs an enormous amount of energy. In a hydrogen atom, this is about 13 eV. Doesn't matter. The Coulomb interaction between these electrons is rather large. And this Coulomb interaction, this interaction between electrons, is denoted normally by U. This picture can be written down in a model, in a Hamiltonian, which is the Hubbard Hamiltonian. Hubbard was 1963. It's a complementary to Mott here. So it's the now I have fermions sitting on lattice sides that can hop F dagger I sigma, F I sigma. J sigma, where the summation is of I and J, the two neighboring hydrogen atoms and of a spin, plus U summation of I and I up and I down, which just gives a penalty, energy penalty, if the two electrons are on the same side. And the fermions, of course, they are characterized by anti-commutation relations. Let me write it down this way. This anti-commutator is the delta function alpha beta. That's the statistics of the fermions. So obviously, if this U part is zero, I have electrons hopping around. This is basically what we call a metal. Now, if the U is finite, the situation is more interesting. Because now, if an electron can hop, depends on a electron being there or not there, or the energy that it ends up, the final state it ends up with after the hopping process, depends on this interaction. So now the electrons are not free anymore, they build up correlations. And the correlations, so I get, as U is finite, I get correlated, I'm dealing with correlated electrons, and I'm dealing with a truly many-body system. What is the, and okay, for the correlated electrons, I can get new properties. Of the solid, new collective properties. And one of the properties, well, there are a bunch. The first one is that I can get insulators, insulating behavior. I can get magnetism. And superconductivity. Where this is more tentative. You need to elaborate on the model here to get superconductivity. Okay, so what's the generic phase diagram of this Hamiltonian, or the simplest thing you can write down? So here my parameter, the only parameter I have is T over U. Or rather, U over T, doesn't matter. And I take T as my unit. And up here, I can have temperature also in dimensionless units. So as I said, if the U is small, I'm dealing with metal. So here, I have a metallic phase. If this U is large, and there is one electron per side, these electrons cannot hop anymore. Because if they would, it would cost an enormous amount of energy. So if U is large and one electron per side, I know that there is an insulator. So there is a metal insulator transition somewhere in the middle. And now the question is, as a function of temperature, if this goes like this or like that, that's a non-generic behavior. I'll just draw it like this. So now you can have systems where if you go from high temperature to low temperature, you have a metal insulator transition. OK. So this is a phase diagram that they introduce coming from a model. Now, we are dealing with materials. And these materials, of course, are not hydrogen atoms in on a lattice, rather they have more electrons.
A question. Yep. So experimentally, is any sharp feature across the metal insulator transition?
It's your temperature, yes.
No, not your temperature, just final temperature.
That becomes a definition question, which is not something, you know, that brings a lot of fruit, I think. But you will have to define first what you mean by a metal at finite temperature, what you mean by an insulator at finite temperature, and what you define to be the difference between those two, which is not completely trivial.
Yeah, but for the first condition, By definition, first transient means something sharp should happen somewhere at the point, right?
Okay, let's, in principle, you know, what happens a lot, many systems, is that actually an order parameter forms here, which is the magnetism. So many times also the insulator is magnetic. Now the question is where the magnetic phase line, how that goes. It can be coinciding with this one, and then that's simple, you have an order parameter appearing at the metal insulator transition. And in most systems, or in a number of systems, this is actually what happens. So there is, for instance, cadmium 2, osmium 2, or 7, to just call, name one. Yeah. So systems where now you have a finite, the metal insulator transition, you could also have a magnetic line that is like this. And now the situation, of course, becomes more complicated because I cannot give my order parameter argument that at the metal insulator transition, I have an order parameter that starts to develop for the insulator. Maybe, yes? Is that okay? Okay, the real materials, here I already wrote down one. But in general, I have not a 1s orbital that's partially filled. It's filled. I have 1s squared. I have, 2s squared. I start having my p levels that I can occupy. Put 6 electrons in there, and now I have the 3s, which is also full, and the 3p, that's full. And now I have the 3d, where I can have a certain number of electrons. So this is the argon core dn. And for systems, these are transition metals. These d electrons are the most correlated ones because their wave functions are most atomic-like. So these are transition metals. Transition metal compounds are the ones we are looking at. Famous MOT insulator is nickel oxide, which is a cubic system. It's a rock salt structure. Another one is lanthanum 2, copper 4, which is a square lattice structure. The coppers are now the correlated atoms. So when I say square lattice, it means that it's a system where you have the copper sitting on a square lattice in two dimensions, stuff in between, and then another copper lattice. It's always a three-dimensional structure. And in these systems, the coupling between the different two-dimensional lattices is small. You have to, of course, also define what you mean with small, but let's stay with that for the moment.
Excuse me. Yep. You might have said I was distracted by peeling my arm. So a MOT material is then one that has this phase diagram. Is that sort of the definition?
So a MOT material is one where you get this insulating regime
separating
happening.
The metal and the magnet.
Yeah. And you could also now again definition questions are always also a bit in the eye of the beholder. But you could say, actually, if I have a finite U, this is already a correlated system, a non-trivial system. I would like to understand correlated metals, which are now, are they materials, yes or no? But they are interesting systems to look at.
Yep. So for bosons, you can identify the MOT phase by lack of response to a chemical potential. Is there something similar to
you? I don't think there is.
It's a concept like compressibility, so there is nothing like you can use as an order parameter.
So you could, in principle, like a gas-liquid transition, you could use density as an order parameter. So there are no sharp measurements of such order parameters, I would say. Okay. Lanthanum 2, copper 4. A very famous one is Fe3O4, which also a cubic system, but now it's a pyrochlore lattice. Somewhat more complicated. And there's Fe2O3, which is another one, which has a corundum structure. just to give you the impression that convey the idea that we are dealing with systems in different dimensions, different ladder structures. Okay. Now the magnetism is already a bit anticipated. I just want to introduce that also. So as I said, if T over U is small, and I have one electron per side, I can expand my Hamiltonian here in T over U. And the Hamiltonian I end up with is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which I now write as J summation ij si dot sj. J coupling is in the order of T squared over U. These S's are spins, the spins of the electron, which is a three-component vector. Right? And okay, I have a commutator, the famous spin commutator, Sx, Sy, oops, equal I, Sz. And permutations. So the statistics of these things are it's a bit different to fermions. Okay. One should say that the one-dimensional system, the Heisenberg model, it has been solved. It was done by Bethe in 1931, which is quite an accomplishment if you realize that Heisenberg introduced the model in 1928. Anyway, please.
Sorry, so even if there's no order parameter, does the free energy have a similarity of the MIT?
Can or must? Must the free energy, can the free energy have a... So there's always the question, okay, so experimentally, let's say that that's the safest, there are models, and there are different models with different properties. So experimentally, the metal insulator transition tends to come with a first order character. Why? Because it's not only the electrons that are active, the density of these electrons couples to the rest of the lattice. It couples to, for instance, phonons. Now, if this density couples to phonons, it will induce a order parameter. And now, in general, if you start inducing order parameters, so even if it's not a magnetic one, you're coupling to the lattice, and that gives you first order behavior.
Structural
transitions. But then the question, purely theoretically, must there be a anomaly or an abrupt change in free energy? I don't know, actually, if that must be. Certainly, there are models where it does. Perhaps also there are models where it doesn't. Maybe somebody else has a better answer than that. Okay.
How do you go from the Hubbard to the Heisenberg model?
Right. So the assumptions are twofold. You assume you're dealing with a system where there are as many sides as electrons. And you're looking at, you are going to, in the parameter regime where the hopping is small, to the Coulomb interaction, which means that in zeroth order, spins will just sit at atoms. Now, if you look at second order, spins will be able to move from one lattice to the other, side to the other, only when their spins is antiferromagnetic. So this gives now an effective interaction between those spins, which is of antiferromagnetic character, which is this J. And this J, so this J is antiferromagnetic, larger than zero. Then you're giving this align the spins opposite. There's no real magic going on there. It's a rather straightforward derivation. Okay. Now the specific thing of the Heisenberg model actually is this dot product. This is an isotropic exchange It does not depend on the direction in the lattice. The Heisenberg model is completely isotropic. Meaning that if you give me a eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, I can rotate all the spins in the same way with an arbitrary angle, and we'll have another eigenstate. So, and that obviously is not the case for a real magnet. The magnet that you put on your fridge will not change its orientation easily. Yeah, if it would, and then if you would have two magnets and have two north poles coming close to each other, then one magnet could flip its orientation from north to south, and you would have a north and south pole that attract each other. So in that, if magnetism would be of this kind, if it would be isotropic, not coupled to the three-dimensional space that we are living in, then always magnetization could take on an arbitrary direction. So the real magnetism is, or the magnetism that we observe, is anisotropic. And the question is how does that come about? And again, Jung Beck gave a very nice argument for that in August. I'll just go very, very quickly, but here is where the relativistic part comes in. So the relativistic materials. Again, consider an atom with an electron circling around it. The electron here gives rise to a magnetic field, which is equal to its velocity times the electric field divided by c squared. So the electric field is the electric field of the nucleus, which is related to the potential, the nuclear potential, like this, as a gradient. Now, if this electron here gives rise to a magnetic field, its magnetic field will couple to its own spin via the Zeeman interaction, B dot S. And you can show in a few lines that actually this B field is proportional to the orbital angular momentum of this electron. In other words, combining this, you will see that there is an energy L dot S entering into your Hamiltonian, purely on the basis of general symmetry. So what is relativistic about it? Well, if c goes to infinity, the speed of light, then the b is zero, and l dot s will also be zero. Only because the speed of light is finite, this has a non-zero coupling constant. Okay. Now, so that is why it's relativistic. I should now also say what is going on now is that I have an l and a s, an orbital and a spin moment of the electron that will couple in general to a total moment j, which is l plus s. Yeah, just addition of angular momenta. This is large when the gradient of the potential is large, which means that if I have a lot of charge in my nucleus, this spin orbit coupling will be large, which means that heavy elements have lambda large. Okay, so So which are the heavier elements? Well, I talked about 3D transition metal oxides. But if you start filling the next level of shells, you get to the 4D transition metal oxides, which obviously are heavier. And the 5D transition metal oxides are, again, in the periodic table, one row below that. So 4D, for instance, ruthenium or rhodium, 5D, for instance, iridium or osmium. Just give me time to take a drink. Yeah. Go ahead.
The outer electrons, don't they see the screened electric field? Why does it go like Z?
Absolutely correct. So I did not say it goes with Z. I didn't say it goes with the Z squared, or I didn't say that it goes with Z to the fourth, which are different textbooks give you different things. But you're absolutely right. What's important is the effective electric field felt by this D electron. So if it spends a lot of time around the nucleus, it will pick up a large gradient, and therefore its spin orbit coupling will be large. If you would have a very heavy nucleus with only an electron in this 4D or 5D shell, so say super heavy hydrogen somehow, then it would scale with the Z to the fourth, because there's no screening of this charge by the inner electrons. So the general rule anyway is heavy elements, lambda larger. This rather scales with the effective gradient of the field felt by the electrons. Okay. So why do this effort? Well, actually, here it comes. B is a vector. It has a direction. So this now couples to the real three-dimensional space, because the orbital angular momentum, again here, is a vector in real space. So this coupling couples the spins that are in principle isotropic, if I only consider the Hubbard model, now to real space. Which are the real materials for which this is going on? Well, strontium 2, iridium 04, for instance, which has a square lattice. Yttrium 2, iridium 207, which is a pyrochlore, three-dimensional cubic lattice. I give three that are similar: sodium 2, iridium 03, lithium 2, iridium 03, and alpha ruthenium chloride. Okay. Any questions, further questions so far? Okay, why do I talk about these three guys? Because actually they are two-dimensional systems living in a honeycomb lattice. Where again, two dimensions, you should always take with a little bit of care, because it means there are planes, these planes are coupled, this coupling is weak compared to something, compared to the something I'm studying. Okay. Now, this is my transition from the what, where, and why to the Kitaev model. So now, instead of talking about the general field, I want to talk about especially these materials and a model, one of the idealized models that's relevant for these materials. Okay. So some of my experimental colleagues call these systems Niro, Liro, and Alpha Ruckel, which sounds like a cast of characters from Star Trek or something. They are much studied now. Why? Because they're, okay. Because their Hamiltonian is very anisotropic. So I should have mentioned here that the Heisenberg Hamiltonian is isotropic. Terms, if you add now Ising type of couplings as Z I as Z J to my Hamiltonian, then obviously these give an anisotropy. And these couple the spins of that I'm looking at to real space where I define some Z direction. One thing I should say before, I told you that the real moment is the combination of an orbital and a spin moment. So in general now, from now on, I talk about J's. I don't like J's, I just stay with S's, because they're easier. Who cares? It's just something I want to mention. It was shown that the Hamiltonian for these honeycomb materials is of the following form. Summation over R E gamma. I'll define what this is in a second. Spin gamma on R, spin gamma on R plus E gamma. These E gammas are the following. I have a honeycomb lattice, so of this type. I have three vectors. This guy I call EZ. This one I call EX. And this guy I call EZ. What does this Hamiltonian say? Well, that on each bond, I have a different type of Hamiltonian. On this bond, between this side I, this side J, I have the spin on this side, coupling to the spin on the other side with XX. So here the spin components X couple to each other on the two different sides. I had a X, I need a Y here, I have a Z there. Now on this bond, the Hamiltonian is the same, but rotated 90 degrees in spin space. It's SY, SY. So Y on one side, R, SY on the other side, R plus E, Y in this case. And on this bond, my Hamiltonian is SZ, SZ. So this is the Kitaev Hamiltonian, which Kitaev wrote down in 2006. And it was shown in 2009 that if I, this Hamiltonian plus smaller terms, is relevant for these materials. I'll not go into the details why. It's a very nice work by Jacquelli and Khaliulin. Okay. So the why is this Hamiltonian, this Kitaev Hamiltonian, so interesting? I can, first of all, the first thing I could do is actually rewrite this Hamiltonian. I just make it simpler. HK is equal to summation over R and gamma. B, R, gamma. Where B, R, gamma are now bond operators. So the bond operators are as X for this direction, as Y for this direction, as Z for that third direction. Okay. What is the fuss about? Well, there are two very important observations that make this model, this two-dimensional model, exactly solvable. The first one is that I can define operators O on each plaquette. So now I have a plaquette of the following sense. I have the XX coupling here, YY here, ZZ here, now again XX, YY, ZZ. on each plaquette, also there's spin operators pointing in the non-bonding way. So here I can take as Z, and this one it is as X, and this one it is as Y, and the third one it is, oops, it's as Z again, as X again, and as Y again. You can show that the products of these six operators, which is, okay, let's say a product on this hexagon, has the following properties. Okay, so let's write it just schematically, x, y, z on six different sides. So as x, as y, as z, as x, as y, as z, as z, where I throw away the integers here. First of all, the first property that it has is that it commutes with a Hamiltonian, this operator, this plaquette operator. And it commutes with a Hamiltonian for all I, for all plaquettes. Second, the operators commute with themselves or with other operators. So which means now that they are good quantum numbers, they are independent quantum numbers. And the third is that you can show that OI squared equal 1, again, for, so this is for all I, this is for all I and J, this is also for all I. OI squared is 1, meaning that OI equal plus or minus 1. I have now good quantum numbers, or constraints, or constants of motion, if you want, that divide the Hamiltonian in different sectors. I can choose my O's in some way. I make one sector, and I can diagonalize the Hamiltonian in that sector without caring about the rest of the world, basically. So I have 2 to the power nh sectors, where nh is the number of hexagons that I have.
So for the condition, yep, number 3, it does assume it's spin 1 half, right? The true point is spin 1 half.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
For the condition number 3, that they require the assumption the spin is 1 half.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes, okay, sorry.
But the Heisenberg one is more general.
Absolutely. I have only talked about spin 1 half so far, and I will only talk about spin 1 half, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is correct for these materials? It's a J 1/2, but it's okay. For spin 1/2, this Hamiltonian couples into 2 to the power nh sectors, where nh is the number of hexagons, and the number of hexagons is half the number of sides or the number of spins in my system. And so it's not completely determined yet. Now, second, B. I can look at the algebra of my bond operators, B, R, gamma. So the B, R, gamma was shorthand for this products of 2 spin operators. One, bonds without common sides, without common sides, B gammas, BR gammas commute, which is kind of obvious. Two, now bonds with common sides, B, R, gamma, anti-commute, which is already special. The nice thing you can show actually now that this algebra is exactly the same algebra that is spanned by a set of Majorana fermions. You can write the summation of the bound variables R gamma, I suppress the indices, as a summation over products of Majorana fermions R, R, R plus E gamma. But now, the Majoranas here anticommute, so the let's write the just the statistics, the fermionic statistics, of course, Ci, Cj is equal to 0 if I not equal to j, 2 Ci squared equal 1/2, 3 a Majorana is famous for being its own antiparticle. So on this level, you just replace one algebra, or you have the same algebra that is created by bond operators and by Majorana fermions. So you might as well talk about Majorana fermions and solve the Hamiltonian. And actually, this Hamiltonian, in terms of Majorana fermions, is a very simple one. It's Majorana, it's three fermions living on a honeycomb lattice. I should say something extra. And actually, here I left some space open because there are some gauge fields appearing here. These eta are gamma, where eta can be plus or minus 1. And you have these etas are related to this operator O. So again, or the of the etas, the product of the eta are gamma on a plaquette is equal to this operator I. So there, that's the, this was called the flux sector of the Hamiltonian, this one. So you can show this, the etas can be plus 1 or minus 1, and you can show that actually in the ground state, they're all the same. You can take all eta equal the same, well, this is the same sign, let's say plus 1. So this is also called the flux sector somehow, sometimes. Okay. I have fluxes. Ground state is flux-free, that all these fluxes are the same. And I have now my Majorana fermions, which are real fermions. So, it's a while. That's interesting because you have a Hamiltonian. You start to form fermions. You made spin out those these fermions. And now you have these spins. And you make then fermions out of these spins. Majorana fermions, but, well, what's the big deal? Well, it's cute that this model is exactly solvable. It's a correlated model. So that's already fine. Or interesting enough, I would say. But now you can ask about the general, the statistics of all the particles that I have in my system.
Okay. Does this system have those three phases that you just erased?
No, because I already assumed I was in this large U part.
Okay.
Yeah. So at low temperature.
This is an effective model for that phase.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, I have the Majoranas on a honeycomb lattice. Well, if I have fermions on a honeycomb lattice, this looks like graphene, of course. Graphene is just normal fermions on a honeycomb lattice. One knows that the dispersion, something of this kind, so dispersion is this energy. This is kx. This is ky. I have these cones. And where here I have my Dirac point. So the fermions are a zero gap, have a zero gap. However, so I want to talk about the statistics. I have to make one step. I have to gap out these fermions because I want to talk about the statistics, not of the fermions, which are fermions, but these fluxes. And I can only talk about statistics of the fluxes if the fermions do not influence it, when the fermions are gapped out. So I can gap out the fermions, which in this picture now, something like this, and here, something like this. I have a gap. I need to create a gap. X, Y. And there are different ways of doing that. For instance, one way is to introduce different couplings, for instance, KZ, different from KX and KY, which are these Kitaev couplings, which I took all the same here, isotropic, but you can take them anisotropic. You can create a gap. Or you can introduce nearest neighbor. Sorry, next nearest neighbor hopping. So just add to this Hamiltonian up here, not only nearest neighbor terms, but also next nearest neighbor terms. OK, now if I get out the Majorana sector, I can ask, what is the statistics of the flux? And he would say, well, there are only two options, really. These are either bosons or they are fermions, in principle. But you could say, well, if I have fermions, I exchange. There's an exchange operator acting on a wave function, which the wave function psi, which depends on x1, x2, well, on many different coordinates. I'll just take two coordinates to keep life simple. If I now exchange this 1, 2, I get psi x2, x1, either with a plus sign or a minus sign. Plus sign bosons, minus sign fermions. Right? And in 3D, this is all there is. Why? Well, if you look at this exchange operator of two particles, 1 and 2, you can also view it as a rotation of this particle to here. And now translating the system back to here. This is an exchange of particles, right? First moving this guy there, and then translating it back. This is the exchange. Well, this translation operator, of course, obviously does not do anything to any statistics of any kind, so it's not relevant. Now, if I look at P12 squared, again, I want to make an argument that P12 squared is 1, so P is either plus or minus 1. If I look at P12 squared, I can view that in the same way as bringing the particle here. So this is 1, this is 2, and then the next step, bringing the particle here. That's a translation up and down, who cares? So P12 squared is bringing one particle around the second particle. Well, if I do this in three dimensions, what do I mean by bringing around one particle around the other particle? It's really not well defined. I have a particle sitting here and a particle sitting here, and I'm saying I'm bringing this guy in the xy plane around. So while I can choose a path and take this path out of the plane, like this, and now it doesn't go around anymore, this other particle. And actually, I can take a path where this electron is just rotating around itself. These are all adiabatically connected paths. In other words, I can, any path in three dimension, I can, or any, if I have the square of this exchange operator, any path I can bring back to the trivial path. In other words, P12 squared has to be 1. There's no way around it. Meaning that its eigenvalues are plus or minus 1, so I have either bosons or fermions in three dimensions. Fine. Now, two dimensions situation actually is much more funny and interesting. In two dimensions, it is, of course, well defined if you bring one particle around the other or not. You have a path in two dimensions. Now I have two particles, one and two. I can either do this or do this. And these are two different paths. You can think about this, for instance, if you have a flux. If this would be a magnetic flux, this would be an electron. Bringing the electron around the magnetic flux, you get a Hadron of Bohm phase, you get a Barry phase, which is different from bringing the electron not around that flux. Now, in two dimensions, I have P12 star has to be equal to 1. With this, I loosely indicate bringing the particle somewhere here and bringing it back again should give you the same situation. In other words, P12 is a phase E theta. Or, well, it has to be a little bit more. So writing the wave function P12 acting on a wave function x1, x2 gives me e to the I theta psi x2, x1. So what is theta? Well, theta actually can be anything, and that's why these things are called anions. Quasi-particles with these statistics are anions, which is Linus and Mirheim in 77, and Wilczek in 82, who coined this phrase, or this term. Okay. Now, as I said, this is reminiscent of the Aharonov Bohm phase of an electron that encircles a magnetic flux. Can you generalize this? Is this all you have? Well, actually, I could have different kinds of anions, and I could have a ground state that is degenerate. So if I have a ground state that's degenerate, I can start with wave function alpha and end up here in a wave function beta, degenerate, but different. If I do so, well, then this thing can have a matrix here connecting alpha and beta, right? If I have more than one anion, actually, this operator will depend on anion type. So here I can put a small a under it. And this matrix here will also be labeled by a. So now I have a rather rich structure by first going to a subspace that is degenerate and allowing for all possible actions of this operator. This is now, okay, this will be the braiding operator. So I one prefers to talk about a braiding instead of exchange because of a couple of reasons. Direction matters. Around the left or around the right is different in general here. And I can do a look at the statistics. I can, of different anions, I can braid different anions. Okay. Now, if you have more than one state, now it becomes rather loose. But I want to make the connection to quantum computing. If you have more than one state of your wave function, if you have two states, you can use this to store information. In principle, any two-state system can store information. This is a quantum system. It can store quantum information. And the idea of topological quantum computing now is using these braiding operators to perform computations, to perform rotations on your qubits, on your quantum bits. Now, there are two different types of these anions, if I have to find this. I can have abelian and non-abelian. Meaning that in the abelian ones, it doesn't matter how I exchange particles, the outcome will not depend on the order. Non-abelian ones, the outcome will depend on the order. That are just two as a very general classification. If the outcome depends on the order, well, that's something you want for computation, right? If the outcome does not depend on the order of the operations, you have a code where you can change any line with another line that obviously doesn't work. So you need non-abelian anions to do topological quantum computation. Okay. So these guys can perform operators on qubits by braiding. Okay. Now the taking this towards quantum computation had the reason that I wanted to talk about the fluxes of the statistics of the fluxes in the Kitaev model. What you can show now that actually these fluxes have anionic statistics. These fluxes, so if I have opened this gap here, got rid of the Majoranas, if I exchange fluxes, they will in general pick up non-trivial phases. And depending on this gap, on the character of this gap, if I have opened this gap, for instance, via making the couplings anisotropic, these the statistics of the fluxes will be abelian. If I did something more fancy, more complicated, and open up a topologically non-trivial gap, then you can show that in this Kitaev model, you have non-abelian, or the statistics of the fluxes, the statistics of the quasi-particles that you now have in your system corresponds to non-abelian anions. Okay.
What is a more complicated gap?
Okay. So you can compare to the situation of graphene, maybe the easiest way. Honeycomb lattice. And I have, in principle, my Dirac cones, electrons hopping from one side to the other side. Now, if I make this, for instance, these two sides inequivalent, A and B, I will open up a mass for my Dirac fermions. This is a kind of, I would say, a trivial mass gap in this case. I can do something more complicated and now introduce hoppings between these sides. And this, okay, this going direction to Haldane's model, if these hoppings are carry a phase, you can also open up a gap. And now Haldane has showed in this 80s paper that now you get a topological gap for your graphene. So in a similar way, actually, you can show that if you have H Kitaev plus a magnetic field B S, let's keep that implicit, maybe summation of all the I's. And this magnetic field B acting on the spins is B to type B11. So it acts the same on SX, SY, and SZ. It's perpendicular. It's in a direction where its projections on SX, SY, and SZ is the same. You can show, it was shown by Kitaev, that in this case, in the Majorana sector, you have hoppings of this kind in lowest order perturbation theory. So I should say that perturbation theory, lowest order, fourth order perturbation theory, actually, I think, with the lowest order that matters, you get this kind of hoppings. And you get a non-abelian phase in the Kitaev model. To talk about it is easy. To show any of that is a big thing. Okay. So, let me know if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'll kind of conclude with the challenges for the future of the field and focus on this, say, Kitaev story. So obviously, the challenges are different for the experimentalist and the theorist working in the field, although there is some overlap. Of course, I would say the first thing for experiment is make a material with HK, which kind of has been done. I have these three materials here that generalize the Kitaev model, but with smaller terms. And the smaller terms, they can matter. Or it's not obvious that they don't matter. In general, they will matter. And that's, of course, a fundamental problem. So you want to make a material that has this Hamiltonian HK, Kitaev Hamiltonian, realized to the most precise degree. This can be crystals, like I talked about, or like the examples I gave, but these can also be heterostructures. So artificially grown structures of molecules, of atoms, one on top of the other. People have become very good in doing that nowadays. First, so you want to make materials that have the HK, and then one wants to determine how dangerous perturbations are. It would, of course, be very bad news that any epsilon perturbation drives us away from the abelian, non-abelian Kitaev phase. Actually, that's been shown that for a number of type of very small perturbations, perturbations going to zero, the Kitaev phases are stable. Yeah. Okay. If you have done that, of course, experimentally, the next step would be measure statistics, or maybe first open a gap in the way that I discussed, measure the statistics of the fluxes, and then if you have measured the statistics, then you want to make fluxes, and if you have made these fluxes, you want to braid them, and if you have done that, you have built a quantum computer. Okay, I'll not write that now. So theory. Of course, there are two kind of theoretical challenges. I would say one is materials related. For instance, an experimentalist says, this is the material I've made. Can you please calculate what is the relevant Hamiltonian in the low energy sector? And again, you also want to know then, which is more model related, how dangerous perturbations are. The third, let's say, challenge for theory, I would say, is more conceptual, or it's getting more and more conceptual, which is game changing. Concepts. Can I add, for instance, this spin liquids in other settings? I didn't stress that at all, but this Kitaev, the Kitaev model does not have ordered states, long-range ordered states. If it would have, it would spoil all the physics. These are, the spins have short-range correlations. And this makes this, in the model at least, the ground states are all spin liquid phases. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
take the Hubbard model and you do second order perturbation theory, you get the isotropic Heisenberg. Could you cook up Hubbard model that gives this funny XX for YZ?
Yes, I could. And it's easy because George Jacquelli already has. So this with Gigant Haljulin, which is this paper here. So for these materials, if you look at the exchange paths now in the presence of spin orbit coupling, you realize as part of the Hamiltonian at least these Kitaev terms. To write down a Hamiltonian, let's say, if I purely theory, I say, okay, I have a Hubbard model, I add spin orbit coupling, I will add some orbital degrees of freedom, and then you can show, if you take that model, lowest order perturbation, you get Kitaev. The big thing there, I think, is that it's really related to the physics in a material system.
So experimentally, how would you couple to the flux sector?
Was that not here somewhere as a challenge? So okay. Step by step, I would say. As far as I know, there is no good answer. At least I don't have a good answer for that. So the way you want to do it is, okay, the braiding this time means that you want to change adiabatically the Kitaev couplings. By doing that adiabatically, you want to take your flux and give it a path around another flux, for instance. So and experimentally, beats me.
If there's some defect in the crystal, would that give you a degree of freedom or something?
I would say in principle, yes.
You're missing a side.
Yeah, so if you're missing a side, then actually, one of the interesting things in the Kitaev model is that you can solve it not only for the pure system, for the system that is homogeneous, as I've shown, but also for all coupling constants being different and all coupling constants between all sides being different. Okay. So disorder, the disorder Kitaev model is also exactly solvable. It can be a projected, or the effective model for that is again a product of the flux and the Majorana sector. So there are degrees of freedom there. So I don't know if anybody really thought about how to do this microscopically, how to braid, experimentally, microscopically, how to braid to fluxes. I would also say it's not a question one should be definitely addressing at this point in time, but it would be interesting to have an idea.
Yes. You mentioned the 2D anions, and what happened to 1D?
I think in 1D you don't really have statistics. So in 1D, if you know a hardcore boson is a fermion, or it's not really a well-defined. You could say in 1D, how do I find statistics? Well, that depends on how I exchange particles, how I bring one particle around the other particle. How do I bring one particle around the other particle in 1D? I don't really know how to do that. So the say 1D is somehow trivial, 3D is somehow trivial bosons and fermions, 2D is a special dimension in this case.
And what if the 1D is periodic?
If it's what?
It's periodic, like it has it's a lattice, it's periodic, but you can make some translations, sort of, no?
You can have a periodic lattice. I think if you look in detail, then you will find out that there's nothing like anion statistics in one dimension.
Good.
Okay. So, if there's no other questions, let's thank you.